thanks for listening to Bow Ties and Business. I'm your host, Tim Kubiak. As always, you can find us on our socials at Bow Ties and Business on Facebook and Instagram, and Bow Ties and B-I-Z on Twitter. You can find me at Tim Kubiak just about everywhere, including Twitter, LinkedIn, and my website, timkubiak.com. Today with us, we have Claire Chandler. She's worked with many diverse startups and corporations over the last 25 years. Claire experienced the most companies fall apart when they start to scale. As a solution to the business time bomb, she created the Whirlpool Effect, a revolutionary way to align leaders and teams around a unifying vision that attracts, retains, and motivates the right talent to achieve your mission. It's a simple yet straightforward process helping many companies find and fix the bottlenecks that are choking their business performances. Rather than go with a pre-scripted interview today, everybody, guys, since I'm a recovering corporate guy who just built out a sales team in my last corporate role, we're just going to have a conversation. So, Claire, thanks for being here.
Thank you. And I can relate, Tim. I am a corporate survivor as well, so I feel your pain.
So what led you out of the corporate world and into this part? And startups are their own animal.
They absolutely are their own animal. And I find that every entrepreneur that I have worked with, come across, cross paths with, we all have this transformational moment that led us or inspired us or pushed us to or dragged us in some cases out of that comfy corporate box and out into the the risky unknowns of entrepreneurship. And my story is no different. So back in 2011, I was knee deep in a corporate role. I was a vice president of human resources for an international company. And I was traveling all the time and going 150 miles an hour. And I was really outside of my comfort zone because prior to moving into that role, I had been squarely focused on all things talent, talent development, talent management, succession planning, recruiting, onboarding, all of that great stuff. And I was being groomed to go into a more executive level HR role. And to do that, I needed to broaden my experience and my accountability to full cycle HR. And so I was traveling all the time. I was so busy that I was able to outrun the voice in my head that would have asked me, am I doing what I'm passionate about? And then all of a sudden I got a call in the spring of that year that I got a cancer diagnosis. And so I had to, stop what I was doing, take a month off of work, have surgery, have follow-up, all that fun stuff. And I was blessed with an outstanding team. So delegating to them and leaving work in their hands was not an issue whatsoever. But in that quiet post-surgery, I finally couldn't outrun that question. Was I on the right path, right? What was I doing what I was passionate about? And I finally had to acknowledge that the answer was no. And so it's amazing how the word no can actually open up possibilities, right? And so once I finally admitted to myself that I was not on the right path or the path that was going to fulfill me, it did open up so many doors and so many conversations and so many what ifs, possibilities. And so I finished my convalescence. I went back into work and I gradually kind of stepped away and outside of corporate. I didn't leave until fall of that year. And I didn't know specifically what I wanted to focus on, but I knew the things that I didn't want to focus on. And so I sort of leapt into the unknown. And just kind of, went out on my own as a consultant, not fully appreciating what that meant, what that was going to do, how I was going to get my first client, what I was going to offer them. But it was exciting, and it was such an exciting exploration of what was possible. So that's kind of how I burst out of the corporate bubble.
Scary leap, right?
Absolutely scary leap. Yeah. Yeah. If you're a fan of Indiana Jones, if you remember that one scene where he's got to take that leap onto the invisible ledge over the abyss as he's going after the chalice, right? It felt sort of like that. He just sort of put his hand over his heart and took that first step, not knowing if the ground was going to be there. Yeah. And then, you know, it's exhilarating. You go from, oh my gosh, this could kill me, to the, you know, the exhilaration of, I didn't die. Let's just keep moving forward and see what's behind door number two.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a ride like no other. But when you went out on your own, and by the way, there's a ton of great resources on your website. So it's clairechandler.net. The yes. links are in the show notes for everybody. And we'll talk about some more of the things that are on the website and what I've enjoyed about it as we go there. And, you know, here, I'd love to hear your thoughts behind it. But you left a big global corporate role and you're working with startups. How do you go from, you know, dealing with what may have been a behemoth to dealing with guys that are, you know, going 1,000 miles an hour and maybe don't have any org structure?
Yeah, absolutely. So what was interesting was, like I said, when I first went out on my own, I didn't really have a very clear picture of who I would serve and how I would serve them. But over time, you know, when you first go out and you don't have a plan, like I didn't, you know, I just left all the doors open. And I just kept looking for different ways that I could bring in a little bit of money, doing some things that I knew I had some skills at. And gradually that led to bigger opportunities. And, you know, over that first 9 to 12 months, I really kind of stumbled into that niche of helping smaller companies, startup companies, mid-sized companies, but less so. But the companies that had zero bureaucracy, very flat organization, but not a lot of structure to support what they were trying to build and achieve and grow. And so, you know, typically my foot in the door was through my HR experience and having that perspective of coming from a global organization, you know, which had a lot of best practices, a lot of structure, you know, a lot of processes already established and nailed down. But, you know, you can't just unplug them from a global situation and try to put them into a startup and hope that they fit. But what I found was, because I was working with companies of that size, I had direct access to the CEO, the president, the founder. And so that really gave me an opportunity to tap back into what I loved, which was more around being an advisor to leadership, being the voice in the ear of, you know, executive leaders who have in their own minds a very clear picture of what they are wanting to build with their company, but perhaps struggle with conveying that in a compelling and consistent way to the people that they're trying to lead. Entrepreneurs are amazingly creative. They're free thinkers. They are, you know, not terribly fond of corporate boxes and bureaucracy, but most of them struggle with people leadership and business management because they're so in their own heads, right? And I'm guilty of that as well. You have so many ideas of what you want to become that you don't stop to think that the chaotic life of an entrepreneur is not necessarily reassuring to the people that are trying to follow your lead.
Communicating that vision in a way that other people get is such a challenging thing. Do you have specific industries or segments that you specialize in?
I do. What's interesting is I think because my background in corporate was more in the energy and environmental space, water and wastewater, utilities, oil and gas. I've always gravitated more toward what I would call the blue collar industries. And so that, you know, kind of opened doors for me to, you know, the chemical industry, the manufacturing industry. I have a great client in the mining and metals industry. So very, very different businesses and services and products that they are involved in, but the leadership challenges are largely the same. And then I have another vertical, if you will, around pharmaceuticals and biotech, and that actually sprang from more of the communications background that I had. So I would be introduced to a larger company to help their HR organization or their communications team craft messages that were more compelling and attractive to outside candidates, internal employees, et cetera. And that opened doors to, you know, helping to realign their leadership. It's interesting. It's primarily kind of the blue collar side with some pharma biotech sprinkled in.
So you got regulatory on this end, maybe different regulatory on this end, and people breaking glass in the middle. That's got to be a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. And it's interesting that observation, because, you know, these are companies that, you know, from startup and small mid-sized to large, they don't want to be told what they can't do, right? They want to sort of break that mold and break the glass. But in each industry, whether it's blue collar or professional services or pharma or biotech, they are put into these boxes because of regulatory requirements or OSHA requirements or, you know, employee compliance needs, et cetera. So trying to, you know, kind of walk that middle line between we want to be innovative and we want to grow in new ways that no one has thought of. And we want to create this environment for people that they can bring their best while still having to fit into certain boxes that the regulators say they must play in, can often be a difficult juggling act. And then you layer on top of that, trying to manage a business so that it is profitable, and lead your people so that they perform at their best and behave at their best. It's a lot to juggle, especially for a smaller company.
It is. So I'm gonna give you huge credit, right? You come from an HR background and you have an amazing sense of humor in the things you produce. Your 50 ways to lose your employees video. And for those of you that are listening, I'll link in the show notes, go check it out on YouTube. You have a really playful edge about it. Is that part of your success?
It's so fun. So thank you for noticing that. It absolutely is part of my success. You know, what is so ironic is, first of all, I spent 18, 20 years in corporate after swearing when I graduated college, I would never work in corporate America because I'm just not that mold. Right. But I made a successful career in corporate America, but I've always had this internal monologue. Whether it's in a meeting or I'm presenting or facilitating a workshop of 250 people, I always have this internal monologue in my head thinking if they knew what I was actually thinking while they're trying to be serious in a boardroom setting, they would throw me out. I had a couple of bosses who would tell me, that I was a bit too goofy for corporate. But I did well anyway. I had a couple of people say my walk was a little bit too happy and could I dial that back because it was really freaking out some people. So of course I just amplified it because, you know, what are you going to do? In corporate, it kept me from getting too weighed down by the bureaucracy. From my very early days, just even doing temp work through college, when all you were doing was doing data entry and making copies, I always sort of looked at it as a game and as something fun. And so now I'm out of the corporate box and I'm as goofy as ever. My humor is very sarcastic. I'm slightly irreverent. And I talk to clients the way that they need to hear the message that the people within the corporate walls have been trying to get across to them. And it's so funny, you know, one of the highest compliments I've gotten from a client is that I am, I'm calm in the crisis. I'm creative with my solutions, but I'm only professional when necessary. And I just thought that was high praise, you know, and invariably every client that I work with at some point in our engagement says to me, are you sure you worked in HR? Because you don't talk like you come from HR. And it doesn't mean I curse like a sailor. It's just, you know, I don't, sometimes leaders need some tough love and sometimes they need straight talk that, their people advisors, their coaches, their HR experts have been trying to get across to them, but they've been too polite about. And if you really want to get to that next level of growth and leadership to the point where people truly follow you, sometimes it takes a little bit of tough love, and you know, I'm there to serve the leaders that I counsel, not to please them. You know, because being surrounded by people who just say yes to them all the time is not going to get them to that next level.
Is part of the beauty of what you do the ability to tell those founders? And I've worked with a lot of business founders in my career, and my background's tech. So, right, I've launched a lot of companies inside of big companies when we've brought their vendors on board. And sometimes the founders, telling them no, nobody's told them no, maybe outside of a financial partner ever.
Yeah. Yeah. It is fun to tell a founder no. You know, being a consultant coming in from the outside does give you a little bit more leverage and freedom to say things to the founder, to the CEO, to the chief human resources officer that their own people perhaps would not say, right? And with some engagements, I do a little bit of, part of my discovery process or my due diligence is to, meet with key employees one-on-one and confidentially just sort of, collect that feedback in aggregate. But I always ask them, what's one thing you would tell your leaders if you weren't afraid to tell them to their face? What's one thing that you wish they knew? And it's always so enlightening, the things that they say and the things that they tell me. And there's often a misconception that leaders can't be approached. Because almost always when I deliver that type of feedback to the CEO or to the founder, and I say, here's some of the concerns that your employees are afraid to tell you, they're almost hurt by that, not by the feedback itself, but by the fact that it took an outsider to get them to open up about it. And so there is often that sort of misperception that there's this glass wall between the executives and the people. And it shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't be like that in any organization, but especially in a startup that's trying to grow. Just because when you grow, you need more structure does not mean you need more walls. You want to keep that open door mindset. You want to keep a culture where people can speak up, take risks, innovate, fail forward, and, really contribute their very best ideas, as goofy as they might be, right? Because if more of your employees did have a happy walk, you'd be surprised at the results you could get.
So with that, how do you determine who's the right employee?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the key word is the right employee, not the best employee. I think often where companies go wrong or go astray is that they all want to hire the superstar, right? But they have champagne taste, but a Budweiser budget. Mm-hmm. And it's not about hiring the quote unquote rock star, because a rock star in one situation is not necessarily going to be a rock star for you. And oftentimes it's finding that diamond in the rough. How do you know who the right one is, though? That starts with absolute clarity on what your mission is, what your company is in existence to accomplish, why you're there in the first place. And that sounds very simplistic, but you'd be surprised how many companies completely overlook getting that dialed in, nailed down, and conveyed in clear and consistent language. I've worked with some founders where on three separate occasions over, the course of a week or two, I've asked them, what is your mission? And I get three different answers from the same guy. It's very clear in their head, but it's kind of fuzzy when you try to put words to it. And until you are crystal clear on why your company exists in the first place, you can't go out. First of all, you can't get the buy-in of the leadership and the team around you, because they can't buy into something that's fuzzy. If they like the concept of being part of a startup because it's fun, it's flexible, they can skateboard from one meeting to the next, there's a pool table in the break room, whatever, that's all great, but that's going to wear off if all they see is management by chaos. they really need to, you know, what's going to sustain a positive, fun, innovative culture, and what's going to sustain the scalability and the sustained profitability of that company. It starts with mission clarity. So once you've got that nailed down, now you can start to break down, okay, what fundamentally do we need in terms of skills, in terms of mindset, in terms of behavior, in terms of knowledge and expertise to achieve that mission? And so now you've got this sort of collection of attributes and characteristics. And you may already have some people on your team that fit that mold, but now you've got a much clearer picture of who you need to be looking for to add positively to the mission that you're trying to achieve.
Does that tie into why you wrote the book, The Whirlpool Effect?
So it does. The Whirlpool Effect, that was not the original title. I was playing around with a bunch of titles, and it, you know, it started from when I first went out on my own and I was trying to establish what my own mission was. I was doing a lot of motivational and public speaking, and I was talking to the kind of frontline employee level and the middle manager level about how to reignite your passion for what you do. You know, being fresh off of my own cancer experience, which really dialed in for me, you know, the whole concept of life is too short not to do what you're passionate about. And so I had these amazing sessions with people, and they would come up to me afterwards and say, you know, you rekindled this for me. I had my light bulb moment during the session, and it clicked for me, you know, what I want to do next. And so it felt great. The problem was I was getting them all jazzed up to be passionate about what they were doing and arming them with how to have that conversation with their boss, and returning them into workplaces, reporting to leaders who were not so enlightened. So they were getting all excited and energized and passionate and saying, okay, with a couple of tweaks to what I'm doing, I don't have to leave my job. I just have to retool what I'm doing. They were hitting their heads against the wall because the leaders were saying, yeah, we can't do that because, you know, we have to fit you in this box. And so what prompted me to write the book was I realized that if I'm really going to help cure workplace misery, I was starting at the wrong end of the spectrum. I had to start from the top. And so I started to write this book really as a wake-up call to leaders who are frustrated with the lack of results, the increase in customer complaints, the office drama, they keep losing their star performers, they're walking out the door. And these same leaders looking around outside of themselves for the reasons why this was happening to them. And so the book was really a wake-up call to say, the root cause is a lot closer than you think. It's really the way that you're leading. And so I was trying to, and that's kind of, you know, really what the book serves to kind of wake people up to. The real root cause is how you lead. But the good news in that is because it's you, it's completely within your control to fix this. And so I was trying to develop a metaphor that would convey what real, true leadership, followable leadership looks like. And I was reminded of a childhood memory. So I live in New Jersey. I grew up in New Jersey. Summers here are extremely hot. And the most popular kid on the block was always the one with the swimming pool. And so all the neighborhood kids would gather at this one house, right? And, you know, having a good time, splashing around and being goofy and whatever. And invariably, somebody in the pool would shout, "Whirlpool." And instantly, we all knew what that meant. We would just stop what we were doing, start trotting around in a circle, make a couple of laps until we could pick up our feet and be carried along with the tide, with the current. And so I thought about that, and I thought, that's what leadership, real leadership looks like. That as a leader from the top down, you have a very compelling message that's simple, that's easy to understand, and it's easy for people to see not just how they contribute to it, but what they're going to gain from it, such that they are going to enthusiastically contribute to achieving that. So that's what the Whirlpool Effect is about. It's truly getting business leaders to go back to what's simple and get to a message that's compelling, easy to understand, easy to attach meaning to, easy to see how it matters to me as an individual employee. and see the results from that, which are, you know, higher retention, higher productivity, greater profitability, more innovation, better growth, better competitive edge, all of those wonderful things. And the leaders find that it's more fun and easier to lead that way. So that's what the Whirlpool Effect is all about.
You did two things in that explanation. You took me back to my youth. I knew exactly what you meant, though I had no idea that that was the inspiration before asking the question. And secondly, I really do see the benefit of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's, and it's so interesting because leaders, there are two types of leaders. There's ambitious leaders and there's aspirational leaders. And ambitious leaders see the trappings of that higher office. They see the leather chair, they see the corner office, they see the better parking space, the higher car allowance, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The aspirational leader says, I don't necessarily want to be in that role, but if that is where I can best serve this company, I'm going to take on that mantle and I'm going to see that, you know, the duty I have to, you know, to lead people effectively. And in both cases, they can become disillusioned by the fact that leadership is not as fun as they thought it would be. You know, the ambitious one may see that it's not, even though they get all of the compensation rewards, it's still more difficult than they thought their power was going to wield, right? And the aspirational one says, I know this is a duty, I know this is a calling, I know this is something I need to do, but I'm somehow lacking the confidence or the competence to do this in such a way that it's fun for them and it's fun for me. And so, you know, that's really part of leadership shouldn't be a chore. It shouldn't be a punishment. And it really shouldn't constrain the growth and the innovation and the, you know, the attractiveness of a company. If you do it right from the right mindset and with the right approach, the results can be amazing.
So that leads me to an interesting question coming from a personal place. The joke I tell people when I work with them and even in corporate life was, I was never the guy you put in charge of something that was working. I was the guy you put in when it was broke and it was ugly to fix or it needed built. Right. Yeah. And by the way, if it worked, I learned the hard way, I'd break it so I could build it again.
Right.
In working with younger companies and high growth companies, how do you help them recognize that maybe some of the people that have been with them from the beginning aren't the right people to carry them where they need to go?
Oh, it's such an important question. And it's an extremely difficult decision point or awakening to get leaders to, because, you know, leaders, really good leaders, really values-driven leaders are deeply loyal, not just to the idea of the company they're trying to build, but to the people that have gotten them to the point that they're at. So it is very difficult. To me, it all comes back to that clarity of mission. One of the positive outcomes, there are many positive outcomes to getting really, really clear on your mission and where you want to go. But one of the positive outcomes is that the clearer you are in what that mission is, how you convey it, how consistent you are, and the connections you make between the people on your team and how they can contribute to the mission, the clearer you are in doing all of that, the more clearly people, you know, the employees on your team will see their place in that structure as part of that mission, or they will see the mismatch. That doesn't automatically mean that, you know, those certain employees are going to just step aside and take their cue and take an exit gracefully. But in a lot of cases they do. And, you know, the clarity of mission makes it a lot easier to have conversations around, you know, employees that are no longer the right fit. Sometimes they're not the right fit in the role that they're in. Right. So sometimes there is an opportunity for them to step up by stepping over into a different, you know, different role or a different discipline. And in some cases, it's a complete mismatch. But the clearer you are, you know, from the top down and throughout the organization, this is what we're all about. This is where we're headed. And this is what and who we need in order to get there. it guides those conversations in a more rational way, right? It's the same reason that conflict resolution is one of the biggest skill gaps in managers and in leaders at all levels, even leaders who have decades of experience in that role. I don't know anybody who, when I use the term conflict resolution, they don't visibly cringe. It's a difficult thing. And a lot of founders and entrepreneurs are conflict averse. And so they're always surprised when they start to hire people that they don't just regulate themselves. It's like, well, this isn't a consultancy you've built. This is an actual company with employees. They're not, you know, independent contractors that just sort of come and go. You've got to provide some cohesion, which means you have to deliver very clear expectations on performance, on behavior, and you have to give feedback that keeps them moving along the right, you know, the right road forward and gets them back on the right path if they're not. So that clarity piece is so key to how you hire, how you part ways with employees, and how you resolve conflict.
So one of your articles, and you can find it on your website, I think it's on, but you can also find it on LinkedIn, right? So you can go to clairechandler.net. You can follow you on LinkedIn. Is you talk about, and I'm actually going to jump to it because I want to get the title right because I kept it pulled up. You don't have a hiring problem. You have a culture problem, right? How do you create a culture in a company that continues to go, right? Now, you know, everybody likes to point at Amazon and say, oh, Bezos has always said this, or Apple's always done that, or blah, blah, blah. But most companies, those are the exceptions, not the rule. And most companies' cultures, I think, have to evolve, maybe as their clarity evolves, but certainly as their structure evolves.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you keep the good?
What a great, great question. And thank you for reading the article, by the way. That's awesome. I truly do believe that the biggest impact on a company's culture is the behavior of its leaders. Leaders tend to think, well, culture is sort of, you know, bubbles up from the bottom, and it's an expression of, you know, the personalities of the collective of employees we've gathered. But that's actually not true, and especially in the case of startups. A startup is always, at least in the beginning, an expression of the founder's personality, always. And there's good and there's bad in that, right? And I don't mean bad as in, you know, evil, that there's an evil twin. Be fun to work with an evil twin sometimes, just to see how I can convert them. But that's a story for another time. But you know, there are always things that they are genius at. Typically, it's being creative and being strategic and being the relationship builder with clients, right? And that's always part of the growing pain, is as we grow, we become victims of our success, that we can't handle the delivery and the execution of every client engagement that we enter into anymore. That's why we need more people, right? And we need the right people. But they have to be extensions of us. They have to complement us in areas that we are not, that are not our genius zone. But they also have to deliver a consistent quality experience to the client, because the client comes on board because they want, you know, they have established a chemistry, a rapport, a comfort level with that founder. And now you're going to say, I don't really get to work with him or her. I work with a team behind them. If they are not truly a cohesive extension, expression of, you know, the founder's vision for the company, that client engagement is likely not going to go terribly well. And it's going to require that founder, that, you know, CEO, to spend an inordinate amount of their time and attention on keeping that relationship fresh and strong, rather than looking for the next innovation, the next client engagement. When I work with startups, they often do ask me that question, or they're at that, you know, that struggle. That's a key growing pain for them, is how do we bottle up what is great about the founder's culture and keep that going with us as we grow? Because the bigger we get, the more geographically spread out we get, the more clients we have, the more experience we gain, the higher the risk we're going to get separated from that, you know, that founder's personality. And the answer is simple, but it's not easy, right? So this is a kind of a quick exercise that anybody can do, at least as a first sort of you know, starting point. And even just a founder who's thinking of adding their first folks because they've started to grow, you know, you can do this individually. And it's basically, if you picture a Venn diagram, you start with a circle that says, you know, what are all the great things about where we were in our past when we first started out? You know, what was so key about why we started this business in the first place? What is unique about what we offer? What are some of the qualities and personality traits of the founder that are magnetic and attractive and, you know, positive? And let's kind of put those in a circle. The next circle is the present, right? So what are our current priorities? What are things that our clients are looking for from us to solve, to deliver, to make better, you know, to innovate, et cetera? And what are some of the things that are unique about that? And what are some of the skills that we are being called upon to demonstrate, right? And so that's your second circle. And then the third one is you probably guessed, is future, right? Where do we want to get to? What is our vision for either that next plateau or even one, you know, 10 years down the line? What do we want to look like? What do we want to be about? You know, what are the types of solutions or innovations we want to offer? What are some of the character traits and behaviors and values we want to demonstrate? And the more specificity you can build into each of those circles, as you enlarge them, where they overlap in the middle is going to be a sweet spot of there's certain things that overlap across the three. And there are, especially from that starting box, there are going to be traits that are very key to your founding that are still priorities now and your clients expect and that you want to retain in the future. So looking at that sweet spot, that's really what you want to kind of package up and bottle up and make sure it is a visible, tangible, expressible part of your brand. So a little homework for your audience there.
Little homework for the audience. I'm going to hit you with one that I don't know you run into often, but it's one I've experienced a lot. And that's a lot of times small companies get acquired. Sometimes they take outside money and they have accelerated growth. And that original founder exits. And I've seen a fair number of times that they bring that executive back 2, 3, 4 years down the road to kind of right the ship. Yeah. How can you structure, if you're the founder, your exit, especially if you have outside board members, right, in a way that can continue on and you're less likely to get sucked back in before your earnout's over?
What an interesting question. And it's very timely because I literally had this conversation with a colleague of mine yesterday who is working with a founder on doing their rebrand. She's a brilliant brand strategist. And she said, this is a founder who started the company 12 years ago, exited the company, and is now being brought back. And she's been gone for, call it 5 years. And she wants to bring back what was so great about that culture and the mindset and the values and the mission and all of that. And it's crystal clear to her because it's exactly the same as it was when she left, but the company has now evolved and they're 5 years, you know, kind of down the road and those paths have diverged. And so what she's struggling with is it's very clear in her mind what they should be about, who they should hire, you know, the types of client engagements they should go after, and how they should behave. And she's struggling with getting the rest of the leadership on board with her vision. So there's a couple of things there. You know, and hindsight is 20/20, but I think your question is a very keen one on those who are preparing for an exit. We often talk about when employees leave an organization, to do an exit interview, right? And it's one of those things that unfortunately in a lot of companies, if they do them at all, it's a check the box exercise. They take the feedback, they don't do anything with it, and they file it in a box somewhere to make themselves feel good that they actually did it. And so that's definitely a mistake. And we could talk about that another time, but you know, with a founder, the exit strategy is as critical as the reentry, right? So the exit strategy, to the degree that the founder can have some control over this, and typically they can, because they can negotiate not just their release, but if they're going to be called back. But as they negotiate their exit, their graceful exit, making it, making part of that contingency, that they retain certain qualities, certain aspects, you know, that sort of past and current bubble of that Venn diagram that we spoke about, so that even if you don't envision you're going to return, that, I'm recalling Jim Collins' Good to Great, right? The best companies are those that not just survive, but continue to thrive, 5, 10, 15 years after the founder or the CEO has exited. And so it's in the best interest of the acquiring company to keep that success going. Their priority is to incorporate them into their larger culture, into their way of doing things. But I have much more often than not, seen the company that gets acquired not get very purposefully integrated into the bigger company. And what happens is there's no real strategic plan for either incorporating them and integrating them into their own culture, or leaving them alone and letting them, kind of keep going autonomously with the culture that they've built and created. It's typically a hybrid of the two, because they both kind of fail, right? And that's why a lot of mergers, crash and burn. They don't get the returns that you hoped for. So it's two things. From the founder standpoint, it's, make part of your exit, conditions that they retain certain aspects of, the culture that you've built and the values and the, sort of the personality. But for the acquiring company as well, make a very, very clear decision and stick to it on whether you are going to fully integrate them into your culture, your processes, your norms, or you're going to run them as a successful offshoot of you, whose culture is so strong and get such positive results that you don't want to mess with success. So those are really the two keys in my mind when you talk about a merger and an acquisition.
So it's not just eliminating duplicate positions and saving money to the bottom line. Fascinating. No.
That's what you hear in the press, right? And that's all they focus on. And then they are surprised that acquisition after acquisition fails, because that's what they focus on. I don't know about you, but I don't walk very effectively backwards. And leaders, they want to move their companies forward, but they focus on walking backwards. And what I mean by that is they focus on lagging indicators. They say, we had a substandard financial quarter last quarter, or we lost some key hires, so we're going to backfill like for like, whatever those duties were. We're going to hire somebody else who can do those responsibilities. That's not the way to grow a company. That's not the way to evolve a company. Every setback is an opportunity to build a stronger business, a stronger culture, a culture and an environment and a business that will help you innovate and grow. And if you're constantly looking at what happened a quarter ago, a month ago, an employee ago, you're walking backwards. And you're not going to see where you're going. And you're going to be surprised when the trajectory you're now on is nowhere near the moonshot that you had planned.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've actually preached it for years. And as a sales leader, it's a dangerous philosophy. But you can't manage your business quarter to quarter. And you can't even manage it year to year if you're not looking 3 to 5 years out and have the patience to get there. Then you're going to just keep adjusting course, changing staff, changing executives, right? And it's a vicious cycle. And once it starts, it's hard to stop.
That's right. That's right. And the statistic is scary, and I forget, but I think it's like 2/3 of new executives fail. More than 50% of startups fail. And part of that reason is because, especially for CEOs, they are beholden to their shareholders, their board of directors, right? And so they're looking at those lagging indicators and saying, you have an 18-month window to get this company on the right road, to get it to, you know, X percent profitability, and to, you know, to turn around what is not working. When you only have an 18-month window to really put your stamp on things and to fix what's broken, to right the ship and to build it stronger, it is impossible to look long-term. And I agree with you. That's exactly where you should be looking. But we no longer have CEOs who have, you know, 10 and 15 and 20 year tenures. They've got an 18-month window, whether they're hired from the outside or grown from within, you know, to build a better mousetrap. And it's a system that's set up for failure, in my opinion.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I have a CEO that I had worked for that had a big company background that recently had something like that happen to him. And he's in the midst of a changing industry. So the industry's, yeah, you know, trying to get 3 years worth of work done in a year and a half. And that was almost it on the nose. You know, tough job.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's interesting. You talked about you don't want to come into a situation where everything's working, right? You want things that are broken. I always laugh at when we put an executive or a senior leader who specializes in turnarounds, in fixing what's broken, and we put them into a project site at a company or an operation or a division that needs a turnaround, that has had years of steady decline because of poor leadership or you know, a myriad other things. And we say, this place is a mess. You're a turnaround specialist. We're going to give you whatever resources, whatever backing, whatever autonomy you need to get it done. And week two, they turn around and they start beating up that turnaround manager for the results that they're getting. And it's like, wait a second. It took us 3, 5, 7 years to get to this place. What happened to all the support and the rah-rah and we've got your back and we realize this is going to take some time? That all fell apart because we have such a short-term memory for knowing that, you know, positive change often takes more than one quarter or 1 year. And we just, you're absolutely right. The tolerance for slow and steady growth, for learning and for failing forward, are very, very low.
Yeah. Everybody wants to make that acquisition and get the hockey stick growth. Everybody wants the, yeah, the silver bullet that, hey, I know we've lost 50% of market share, but we got it back in 12 weeks. It's amazing. Right.
Right. Right.
And barring inventory constraints, that's not going to happen.
Right. Supply chain and all that fun stuff. That's right.
Yeah. Which is a whole nother topic. Your website, you have a couple of different programs on it. Do you mind sharing with what they are and maybe who's a good fit for you?
Yeah. So I, as you probably have guessed throughout this conversation, I specialize in working with CEOs, founders, and business owners, you know, from startup to mid-sized companies that are at a point where they want to scale, want to get to the next level, you know, and don't necessarily know all the things they don't know, right? And they want to avoid the growing pains of, you know, not necessarily having all the right people. Not necessarily having the right leadership structure and processes in place, you know, starting to see the level of service and customer satisfaction drop off because people are getting distracted by all the things required to pivot and to scale. So I work with, you know, the top leadership down because that's really where that stabilization has to start. It's with getting that clarity around your mission, the fundamentals that you're going to need to, you know, to compel that mission forward. And then all the sort of the talent, people, leadership, process infrastructure that's going to be required to support that. So I do that in a variety of ways. And, you know, if people are curious, I would love them to visit clairechandler.net. You'll find out more about me. There is a media page where you can learn a little bit more about my irreverent take on things. And then there's a resources page. The resources page I'm continually adding to, but there are some free goodies on there that will really help you know, leaders of companies of any size really kind of diagnose where they are currently. You know, in terms of the mission readiness of their company, the the real cost of the turnover that they're experiencing and all the money that they're leaving on the table, that one tends to make people kind of freak out a little bit. So that's not for the faint of heart, but definitely they should look at that. And there's some other,
Don't read it before bedtime.
Yeah, I would definitely not do that as your nighttime activity. But it's, you know, it's there are a couple of really good sort of diagnostic tools in there. And then there's a variety of ways that people can reach out to me and set up some time, you know, have a no cost, no obligation chat. We'll kind of talk about where you are, what you're, you know, what's kind of rattling around in your head, and see if we can clear out some of the, as I call it, the head trash and get you on the right road.
So how do you define a mid-sized company for yourself when the clients you work with? Because that's could be a broad spectrum, right? It could be 10,000 employees, could be 100.
Yeah. So my sweet spot is really companies. I do have some companies that are smaller than 100 employees. My sweet spot, though, is really the 250 to 5,000 employees. And I know that sounds like a big sweet spot, but it really does. Like I said, I mean, industry to industry and company size might vary, but a lot of those core issues are very, very similar when you peel away the symptoms, right? When you peel away the symptoms and you get down to the misalignment and the lack of clarity at the senior leadership levels, once we fix that, a lot of those other symptoms start to go away. And then you really start to, you know, take the brakes off and really let things fly.
Just a question, knowing your background, are some of the companies you work with, you help them with multinational or international expansion? Because in that size, I would think you'd start to get into that.
I don't specialize as much with international, although I have advised some companies that are going in that direction. I do typically focus on the U.S. leadership, okay. But I have worked with leaders in Canada and in Europe.
Yeah, and because that's a whole different ball of wax, right?
Yeah.
Americans, I worked for a Brit and his name was Simon. I worked for him for 5 years. I came back and took a role in North America. And I walked into the first North American board meeting and I was interacting the way I'd become accustomed to in the UK, because that's just what you do. And everybody's like, man, are you a jerk. Yeah. What is wrong with you? They're like texting him. He texts me. He's like, what are you doing? I'm like, talking like I talk to you.
Yeah. So, you know, I've worked for a bunch of Brits. One of the best CEO I ever worked for and with was a Brit. And they are very, he was kind of a unicorn. He was just so special, but a lot of the other British managers, were also great, but very performance management metrics focused. And it's, if you don't see that coming, you can very easily, you know, misread them as sort of crusty and cold.
Yeah, exactly. He's just trying to go five questions deep and I just got into the habit. So it happens.
Right. Oh, I love it.
So you've got a great YouTube, right? We've talked about your website. You've got a podcast. You haven't talked about that at all. So why don't you tell people what they're going to hear, what they're going to find on there and where to find it.
Yeah. So I actually don't have my own podcast. I've been doing several episodes such as, you know, coming onto your great show and talking with, you know, established podcast hosts. But I've been on several now and your audience can find those on clairechandler.net. And also on SoundCloud, but the link is on the homepage of my website.
Okay, beautiful. Claire, thanks for being here today. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Same here. I appreciate you having me on.